What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Gadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. Joining me today is Senior Writer Sam Rutherford. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good. Sherlyn is off. She's also taking a much-needed break this week. But she did want me to relay a message. An early birthday to Sam Rutherford. Hello, Sam. Happy birthday.
Hey, thanks,
It's this weekend, right?
Yes, it is this weekend. My wife recently asked me, he's like, do you remember how old you are? And I had to say yes, yes.
Yeah.
And then I think I just don't want to talk about it anymore. There's certain milestones that are like still meaningful. Like you can, you know, rent a car at 25 and some other stuff. And I'm way past all those. And so they don't mean anything.
It's like, it's the renting a car. It's waiting till 30 and then 30 hits. And you're like, okay, whatever, man. Whatever until you're 40. But anyway, congrats. Happy birthday, Sam. I hope you have a
good one.
Do you have anything fun planned for the weekend?
No, just trying to take it easy because of all the recent reviews.
Oh, man.
So it's just like my reward is not having to work on the weekend.
That's the best birthday gift. I've noticed a couple times this week. I got to nighttime. I was like, wait, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to don't have to test anything. I don't have to write anything. It's amazing.
What is this weird feeling?
Well, among the things we have been reviewing are the Meta Quest 3, which I put up my review this week. Sam, you did the Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro. So we'll be talking about both of those in this episode. And joining us to talk about the Quest 3 will be a special guest. He's coming on soon. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a review on iTunes. You know, you can subscribe anywhere, to be honest. You can also drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We'd always love your feedback, so please send us some notes. So the Meta Quest 3 finally launched this week. My review is up on the site, and joining us to talk about it is Norm Chen, co-founder and executive editor at Tested. Hey, Norm, how's it going?
So good. It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Like, Norm, I specifically wanted to get you on because I looked at your coverage of this thing, and you published an hour-long review of the Quest 3. And I just have to say, like, that's one thing that made me feel like, man, oh, I thought we went a little far by putting, like, 10 minutes on our Engadget video. But no, Norm, you went deep for an hour.
And thank you for putting all the chapters on all the different sections. That is like incredibly awesome. Thank you.
I gotta give credit to our viewers. The chaptering was done by our viewers who we appreciated. We just copy and pasted that. They went but
gotcha.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun making that review.
Awesome. Yeah, it was good to watch. Everybody go check that out at on the Tested YouTube channel. I reviewed the Quest 3. I quite like this thing for a bunch of reasons. I do think it is a nice upgrade over the Quest 2, but I think the big downside is that the Quest 2, when that thing launched, it was $299. You could tell anybody on the street, like, hey, you wanna dabble in VR? You want a taste of this stuff? Spend, you know, a decent chunk of money, but not, you know, half of $1,000. But you could spend that money, hop into VR, don't have to plug into anything. The Quest 3 starts at $500 now. It goes up to, what, $630, $650 if you want the 512 gigabyte version. This seems like the upgrade for the Quest 2, but not the entry point for new people. Norm, what are your overall thoughts on the Quest 3?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a technology standpoint, it is an upgrade. It gets us inches closer. You know, it's a big step closer to what people want, like the general layperson, I guess, when they hear about VR. And you know, as people covering VR for so long, we know one of the big challenges is communicating what that experience of presence is like, what is appealing, because there are so many different use cases for VR. In many cases, Meta and / Oculus, right? This is like a second try from 3 years ago, getting the mainstream. They spent so much money. I'm sure they sold the Quest 2s at a loss. And to their credit, you know, with all the advertising, you know, if you watch like sports events, like they're all over. They heavily advertised it. Timing kind of worked out almost in their favor just because people were at home, a little more disposable income, you know, eager to try it out. And Quest 3 is like, here we go again. So it's for people who already believe in VR and who maybe purchase a lot of games, do PC VR. I feel like it's such a worthwhile upgrade, especially if you didn't buy into the Quest Pro last year. All the technology is meaningful. All the things that they've done in research for the lenses, for displays, even on the software side, the hand tracking. But really, for a mass market device, because no longer are we 10 years into VR, these, you know, niche devices, is this a PlayStation 2 to PlayStation 3 moment? Right. And I think they're still in the, like, this is a niche category moment.
Yeah, this is this feels like the upgrade. The VR was already a niche category, but this feels like an upgrade for a niche of a niche, right? Like, because I think newcomers are still probably better off with the Quest 2. You could also probably find that thing used or refurbished for less than $300. I think it's worth remembering, last year Meta raised the price of the Quest 2 to $400 because of supply chain issues. So for them to go back to $299, I guess it feels like a bit of a discount, but no, that's what the Quest 2 launched at. I would have been impressed if they had somehow gotten that thing down to like $250 or even less or something. But they have wasted so much money on VR, I feel like that's not possible anymore. One thing I want to shout out here, yeah, this is a new headset that has high resolution, new lens designs, high resolution display behind it. It's lighter, but I think also most importantly, it has two mixed reality, full color mixed reality cameras on the front, which enable this sort of like view into the real world that we've never had before in a Quest headset. Like, it's been black and white before, right? What's the Quest Pro color? I forget.
Quest Pro's color, it's a single camera RGB, and I'll yes. do one correction. It's actually technically heavier than the Quest 2. It just feels lighter because all that hardware is, and these are the subtle things, right? If you're just looking at the spec sheet and say, you know, finally does, you know, RGB pass through, you know, plenty of other VR headsets did RGB pass through. Vive Pro 2 did that, you know, Quest Pro did that, Pico does that. But, you know, what I think Meta's going for is, and this is a hard problem to solve, is stereo correct, reprojected pass-through where objects in your near field in the distance look exactly right where they should be. If you close one eye, close the other eye, and if you take off the headset, you know, where your hand is, where your phone is, it's exactly where that is. And that's not an easy problem to solve, because where the lenses are, even though they're closer to where your eyes are, they're not depth correct. You know, your eyes are kind of recessed into your skull, and so they're processing these images at, you know, 60, 72, 90 frames a second to actually place them where your eyes are. And that's a really hard thing to do. It's
impressive.
Yes.
There's also a depth sensor in between the two cameras, which the Quest Pro did not have. So that's kind of wild.
Developers actually said that developers who I've spoken to who worked on the Quest Pro said that that was part of the original design spec when they were prototyping software for Quest Pro.
Yeah.
It was intended to have that. Yes. Obviously, the rumors were such that, you know, you can do depth sensing in a couple of different ways. You can have, you know, stereo depth. You can do a time of flight sensor. You can do what, you know, Apple and the FaceTime cameras do, structured light. And IR cameras, there's always been this privacy concern. So I think when they launched Quest Pro, there was already privacy concerns with eye tracking, with face expression tracking. And so whether it was a cost-cutting measure or just to get ahead of the privacy concerns, they decided not to do that there. And so I'm not sure that the depth sensor in the Quest 3 is exactly the same hardware as what they intended in the Quest Pro, but the benefits of it are definitely significant.
It's very, I can feel that difference. So Sam, you had some time with the Quest 3 too on the preview. I know you've used a lot of VR headsets as well. Like, do you have any thoughts about this thing just as an upgrade from the Quest 2?
Yeah, and it's something that like I thought about more as I was watching Norm's video, and it feels like what I really appreciate is some of like the maturation in design technology, because like you, like I don't wear glasses, but you were talking about like, hey, it's so much easier to just wear glasses. You don't need the prescription lenses. And even just like the little things like the charging dock, like even the charging dock compared to the Quest Pro's charging dock, it's so much easier to use. You know, the controllers just fit right in. There's no more tracking rings. And it's so, but also like the face plates and the padding and just like the overall weight distribution and all that. And it feels like we're really getting to a design standpoint where it is just more accessible to, you know, hop in and out. People, you know, you don't have to worry about like, hey, is my face going to fit? Are my glasses going to fit? How am I going to wear this thing? Even just like little stuff, like being able to take the loops, the tassels off the controller super easily. And so that's the thing, like, to me, that was like one of my big impressions about it. Just like, it feels like we're getting to a point where headset design is just a lot more understood in a way that works for everybody.
It's been what, almost a decade at this point since we've got consumer VR headsets out there. So yeah, we damn well better get to some understanding here. One thing I couldn't help but think of too, Norm, is also Apple's Vision Pro, which is a similar pitch. Apple's never saying VR, but they are talking about spatial computing and mixed reality. And essentially the Vision Pro has you know, the RGB cameras looking out. Like, a lot of the time, you will be looking out into the real world. From what I remember of the Vision Pro hands-on, I think you got to try it too, right, Norm?
Yeah.
That was a nice clear view of the real world. This is not as clear. Yeah.
Well, I would say it was a nice clear view in the controlled environment that we got to use it in, which is a very evenly lit indoor simulated living room with very clear flat walls. And to piggyback off of what Sam was saying, I think what you're saying is, you know, friction, right? Hardware friction. And if you want to use the computer analogy or the game console analogy, it's like it's plug and play, the equivalent of plug and play, but, you know, put on your face and play, which I think we're getting closer to that. For the hardware side, you know, the fact that hand tracking could work, and the rumors being that they may potentially release a hand track only, you know, SKU, where that's how you would get to the lower price point, is not even need controllers.
And support for things like micro gestures and whatnot.
Exactly. But I think they would still have a lot of work to do on the software side. You know, a lot of the frustrations that even Quest 2 users had on how difficult it is to pair up with friends, update your software. Again, going back to the console analogy, you never want to have a case where, you know, if you're using a device once a week or once every couple of weeks, next time you turn on your PlayStation, you got to go through firmware updates and system updates and game updates. Like, VR still has that issue where people aren't using it as frequently as their smartphones, where it needs to be more seamless, so easy to get in. And Vision Pro, I think, is more... addresses a lot of the comfort stuff and a lot of the just kind of with the pass-through cameras and also the display on the outside. It feels like the thing they're going for is just making this as normalized to use in a environment with other people.
Just kind of shaving away the weirdness, but Vision Pro, crucially, does not fit glasses, right? So you got to get those prescription lenses. There is that initial friction for you to achieve the sort of like perfect Vision Pro world. I do want to say, like, it just really struck me, just the simple ability to like double tap on the Quest 3 and see the real world felt groundbreaking to me, because we had passed through it before, but it was like black and white. I used the Quest Pro a bit, but that was not a great headset. Like, I did not spend much time in that because there just wasn't much compelling. There wasn't actually much built for the Quest Pro. So the Quest 3 has a lot of this stuff, has depth sensing. So I could actually tap out of VR, look at my phone when I get a text, look at some Slack messages, and pop back into VR. In the past, I'd have to like take off the headset completely, or with some of those like great Windows mixed reality headsets, like you could flip up the visor. Those things are pretty much dead right now, and that whole concept is dead. I felt less trapped in VR with this, and I think that's a big thing. Did you feel that way, Norm?
Absolutely. And I, the double tap on the side, that's been there since Quest 2. To their credit, they've been updating hand tracking and on all these software things. And so for people jumping in, they get inherited all those benefits. It's an interesting debate about like what these headsets are for, because, you know, through 2-3 years ago, with their pivot to the name Meta and the metaverse being such the big pitch and creating basically a whole industry just on that concept, you see them walking back from that more this year, with mixed reality being the pitch here. And I think some of that's an answer to Apple, because their headset is not a metaverse pitch. It's not a in virtual environment pitch. And there are certainly virtual environments. They call them immersive environments for cinema and the like. But they're calling it spatial computing. And I think Quest 3, even though I don't think Zucker Boss specifically said spatial computing necessarily in the keynote, I really enjoy that aspect of the Quest 3, where the pass-through of the real world isn't necessarily about putting things in walls or these augments or whatever, but it's about making the objects that are projected in front of me, this virtual web browser, you know, the Facebook feed, the Messenger chat rooms, all that stuff, live more naturally in a play, and I feel less isolated, and there's that extra comfort where I don't have to be in a virtual home environment, where my home can be the environment.
My initial headline for this review was like Vision Pro Lite, and I feel like if I ran with that, the Apple people would kill me. So it does feel like we're almost there, though, because to be clear, when you're in mixed reality mode and you're looking at the real world, you can't pull up this sort of transparent tray in front of you. You can run up to 3 specific apps, not like VR games, but it can run like the web browser. It can run WhatsApp. I paired WhatsApp from my phone to the Quest 3, and I could see all my WhatsApp chats, and everything looks so super crisp and clear because the displays are much better. I could just sit there and like have like a multitask in the Quest Pro, in the Quest 3, while also still seeing the real world. I think the promise of the Vision Pro is sort of like, well, you also get to, you get a better look at the real world. So you can also like have, you know, you can both project your Mac's display into the Vision Pro, but you can also still see stuff on your iPad or still see stuff from your phone more easily. I think the quality of the Quest 3's cameras, it actually looks good when we record video in your video, Norm. Like the in-camera footage looks really nice. It looks almost 1080p. But when I'm looking at it with my eyes and when it's spread across the VR headset, it's not that like high quality, right? Did you call it more like a digital point and shoot?
That's what, we're in that point and shoot days where images are so grainy. There's processing to make them muddled, and I think even on the Apple side, the Vision Pro side, they're doing heavy processing. You know, every time you like zoom into an iPhone image, you look at their display stack. There's post processing that happens on iPhone photos. They're doing the same kind of algorithms on a 90 frame per second basis on the Vision Pro stuff. That multitasking that you mentioned, that's like my favorite stuff to do on the Quest 3 right now. These progressive web apps where it's web browsers, where Spotify is there. Like, and I think Meta has kind of dropped the ball because there was an opportunity with the Quest Pro for them to really get developers to make these progressive web apps, especially with the more RAM on the Quest Pro with that 12 gigs. Like three windows, that's all I need. I don't need to necessarily mirror my desktop. I just want a good web browser. I want Slack. I want like Discord, you know, a good Reddit app or something. And that's great. Now I have browser instances, and it's good enough where I can do like YouTube TV, you know, Twitter or YouTube, and videos look fantastic. But I want these native apps, and I think that's where the developer conference, where they announced Vision Pro, like that's where Apple has that leg up. If they can convince developers to make these native spatial apps, that's going to be a big selling point for people who are willing to spend that money.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised there's not like a beautiful interactive Instagram app or something. Like I really lean into what you own it. Just like highlight it, Facebook. What's going on here? What were some of your favorite experiences in testing the Quest 3, Norm? Because I really enjoyed the Kurskasat game, which is sort of like the Kurskasat, you know, YouTube videos. They have like really cool science facts and stuff, like videos that teach you things, but the game itself can both teach you things and show you like the scale of VR. I didn't really get to try First Encounters, which is their mixed reality game. I know you tried that, Sam, because it just wouldn't work on my headset. I get to get a new build of it or something. So I didn't get to try that, unfortunately. Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's a demo. I mean, it's a demo. It's not a full game. It's like a short, you know, 15-minute arcade experience to show you the potential of that mixed reality of mapping your walls. And I go deeper into this in my video about
the ways you can map the walls.
Sure. Yeah. You go through the room mapping process. The depth cameras allows the system to recognize what is a wall. And so once the four planes of your walls are more than four planes up, you know, your ceiling even are mapped out, they will then, you see video of your wall, but then they actually render geometry behind it, and these aliens blast through and create these cracks and holes in your wall and fly through. Remember that Microsoft HoloLens demo we saw, maybe it was like CES 10 years ago with like these spiders crawling through the wall. It's finally that in your home, but as opposed to optical pass-through, it's video pass-through.
Magic Leap had a similar demo for the first Magic Leap 1, I believe. Like there was something related to Dr. Korborg's stuff.
Yes. It was like Sprout or something.
So I know, Sam, you saw this in your demo. Like, was this a compelling thing? Is it enough for you to upgrade from the Quest 2?
I think for me, what I appreciate about it is that it carried a lot of the technological generations and advancements and kind of distilled it into a way that felt more intuitive for people who have never used VR. And that's kind of what I appreciated about it, in that, like, it's doing things that you didn't think VR could do with just a single headset. Because people are just like, hey, we usually need lighthouses and, you know, all these different things. And it's like, oh, hey, this is really cool. And to see that kind of distilled down into a self-contained package, because I think we've all seen that, like, oh, we had mobile VR where you're putting smartphones in headsets. And like that was a kind of intermediate step. And then we had, you know, tethered PC and PC VR, which is great, but it's not, you know, that's not where the mainstream kind of direction is. And you know, kind of getting that into a self-contained standalone headset was just, you know, really nice kind of, oh, hey, here's a pause, and, you know, here's where the evolution of VR has turned into.
Gotcha. I think that's a great point. Yeah. I mean, like, mm-hmm. you think about all the early adopters, everyone who spent $1,000 plus on a full Index set or, you know, a Vive set. And you know, even when the first Oculus Rift came out, didn't come with any track controllers, came with an Xbox controller. You're paying north of $500. You had to set up two cameras, all this USB setup. It was clunky. And even though it was a consumer product, you know, in terms of the polish of the packaging, it was an early adopter device. And this, even more so than the Quest 2, feels like the friction of that is gone, that hardware friction.
Yeah, we've made some progress. I can't help but think about like where we are now, though, with VR and everything. Like, this is how I was feeling in the PlayStation VR 2 reviews. Like, that's great hardware, but why should you spend, you know, $650 for this thing on top of like having the PlayStation 5, on top of like, you know, not knowing if there are going to be more games coming out after that initial launch. So I wanted to talk about like where we are now with the metaverse and the state of VR overall. I know podcast producer Ben wants to chime in, and you have some thoughts on like the metaverse as a whole too, right?
Yeah, because Engadget is not my only thing. I actually just finished a stint as a story editor on a show that I'll plug later on about the metaverse communities. And so this is a good opportunity to widen the discussion to like, where is the metaverse right now in October 2023?
Yeah, it feels like Zuck Basic never really even said metaverse during the last Connect conference, right? Where he unveiled the Quest 3. What do you think? They changed their name to Meta, Norm. Like, what do you think the company is, how are they thinking of the metaverse at this point?
Yeah, I think it's Horizon Worlds is their metaverse right now, right? And you know, if you look at the various definitions, like the metaverse is just this fancy way of saying, you know, multiplayer gaming, social applications that have some type of backend interconnectivity, and whether that's a Horizon Worlds type of thing, or if someone else is going to build it, you know, the way I think about it, you know, Rec Room is its own metaverse. VR Chat, obviously, all these applications where people are building communities and memories and infrastructure on their own.
Fortnite, a lot of those is its own metaverse. Like,
it's, absolutely,
it's all, yeah.
Roblox, Fortnite, absolutely, right? I think stagnant. It's stagnant in that the money that they invested on Meta side and Horizon Worlds really didn't pay off and wasn't necessarily, like, the priorities weren't there. You could tell they tried to do the things that other multiplayer communities had had success with, but were limited perhaps by, you know, they couldn't infringe on IP the same way, you know, VR chat users could.
Yes, that's true.
And also as a response to Apple, seeing potentially, you know, maybe that metaverse stuff is going to still be more like 5 or 10 years from now. There's still the Quest 2 definitely wasn't the right platform. It didn't overcome just the minimum barrier to entry to get people using the headsets on a regular basis for them to even consider what type of virtual community they want to be a part of.
So to add some numbers to what you just said in terms of Horizon Worlds being stagnant, I found an article published just about exactly a year ago today in the Wall Street Journal. According to some documents that were leaked to Jeff Horowitz, this is the same reporter who helped break the story of Francis Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower. So according to some of these documents that he got a hold of, there are just about 200,000 monthly active users.
And that was a year ago.
On Horizon Worlds. Yeah. And that 200,000 number was a revision downward, which likely means that there are probably fewer users on Horizon Worlds today.
There's definitely a fraction of that using it today. Like, that's the whole thing. And I did some testing of this. Like, I did some of the, like, activities. I did some, like, guided tours with Facebook about this stuff. And it's cool. Like, I did some of the virtual meetings, and the virtual meetings are cool as well. If you go back and look at our coverage, I did one of those, and I ended up sitting next to Zuckerberg's avatar.
Oh, yeah. Same here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it's like one of those things where it's like, oh, this kind of feels like I'm sitting next to Mark Zuckerberg. That's weird. And I had this whole thing where I was like, okay, well, I guess I got to pay attention to where my virtual hands are, right? I got to I got to be somewhat proper here.
And you have to worry about where your legs
absolutely.
Were, or was that before?
I worried about where I was looking. I didn't want to just be like an avatar staring at Mark Zuckerberg, because like then social conventions come in. So that was kind of interesting too. But if you go look at other video coverage of it, I think we put up a video of it and other people have me in their videos. You look at my avatar, it's just freaking out. Because it's like, it can't track fully where my hands are. My hands were like in front of me, and I guess something was interfering. So I really like virtual meetings, but there's so much friction there. Like, unless you're already wearing a headset and then you can say, hey, you want to pop into a virtual room and talk or something, I think that could be cool. But I don't think anybody's going to want to put on a headset just to do a meeting. You know, I feel like that's also another problem.
Yeah, you have to already be in the headset already. So they have to make compelling all the other things that you'd normally be doing on a day-to-day basis, you know, and then also add, and they had asymmetry, so people could be joining that via their laptop, via their phone. You get a windowed into that. I think asymmetry is undersold. I think you've got to have it. When we're still talking about the single millions, you know, the seven-figure to maybe low eight-figure number of people in headsets, for many of whom are just have them in drawers, you got to make software. You got to make the metaverse more than just people with headsets. And it doesn't need to be fully immersive. I think that's what we're learning. It doesn't need to be completely virtual environments. It can be a mix of flat screen. You could be in headset using a flat screen window, like looking into a Zoom window, but still be in a headset. Like, you have to allow for all these multimodal ways of interacting.
Seems hard. I think that's the ultimate thing. Like, Facebook was like, we're going to do the metaverse. And this seems like a 10-year project, not like a 3 or even 5-year project.
Every time it's like they bit off way more they can chew. And it's like, you know, hey, you can make a Verizon, you know, a Horizon Worlds, but it's still siloed from the rest of the VR, AR community. And I think, like, you know, you have this playground, but then you need other people to build on it. And I think that's the challenge, is like, when you have, you know, a self-contained thing like Horizon Worlds, it's not like it's fully or as, you know, as accessible as like the internet, where, you know, you can build a website, anyone can build a website, instead of building it on a certain company's platform. And I think, you know, that is like going to be a big challenge. And even like, you know, talking about like your, you know, social interactions, you know, they didn't bring the facial and eye tracking from the Quest Pro over to the Quest 3. I think it was a smart business move, but in terms of like overall VR development, you know, at some point we are going to have to need those trackers and sensors to be able to have, you know, more realistic, more lifelike interactions with other people.
So, yeah, you were just talking about like the lack of people to make the metaverse, especially Facebook's metaverse, more lively feeling. I think that part of that is because Horizon Worlds is like a Disneyland of the metaverse. It is not allowing like the full width of human experience to be translated into the metaverse. It doesn't really want the full width, including the seedier parts of the human experience, to be translated to the metaverse. In fact, didn't the Horizon avatars just get legs like last year?
It was like last year. Yeah.
And so in this show that I just finished, one of the really compelling case studies that I fought to get into the series was this idea of VRF Gym that was in VR chat, and it was just a bunch of people doing workout classes together. The thing that got the people into the workout classes is the fact that it was basically workout classes for furries. These were incredibly detailed VR avatars with like movable tails and you know, ears that you can twitch cutely, all decided they wanted to do aerobics together. And that doesn't seem to exist in Horizon Worlds yet, which could be a huge hindrance.
And where were those taking place? Those weren't they happening in VR chat, Ben?
Yes, it was happening in VR chat.
VR chat is where it is. I reviewed this movie, We Met in Virtual Reality, last year. It was at Sundance, and it's a documentary filmed entirely in VR chat, covering how people have made like real life friendships and relationships. I think one couple was getting married based on their like, they live in different countries, but they hang out in VR chat and they have like a connection to each other. You got to remember, like, the internet, I think we're all old enough to remember like when the internet started, right? Or at least like have some memory of it. And I remember the 90s, and I'm not even going back to like, you know, old school message board days, but like in the 90s when it was like AOL, CompuServe, and Yahoo, those were sanitary environments, but then you could easily go to the main, you know, web and go to rotten.com. or something, or go like stumble into a very bad IRC chat, or stumble into a place where like, oh, I should not be here because this is gross or also really weird. But also, I think that's the breadth of human experience, right? It's just like the worst parts and the best parts of humanity open to live as it can. I don't think VR can do that yet, right?
People are going to want to be horny in the metaverse, and Horizon Worlds does not allow you to be horny.
Yeah. Disneyland analogy is really, I think, apt because it's their vision, their guided and I think it's a combination of it being not only family friendly because of all their liability, but also really banking on user generated content. Like they know they only have so many resources to create the entertainment, and they looked at what Rec Room was doing, what Roblox was doing, and they wanted to create a sandbox that hopefully was compelling enough for users then to propagate. But it wasn't I don't think it's that necessarily that content that gets people interested. It's all the emergent behavior and emergent interactions that a place like VRChat allows. And that's not necessarily, doesn't have to be seedy, but when you have fewer guide rails, then you allow for people to just create weird things.
Being open to weirdness, I think, is kind of key.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the weirdness can be disembodied. It doesn't have to be analogous to our experience in the real world, IRL. And that's one of the appeals of VRChat, one of the appeals of VR and the metaverse, is that the rules of the real world don't have to apply. I'm talking about just basic senses of identity and physics. And so Horizon Worlds, the building blocks they've created are way more restrictive that way.
Mm-hmm. I think that feels inherently stifling too. Norm, I want to ask you before you go, like, you are still seeing new VR headsets. I also saw a review of the Big Screen Beyond VR headset, which I'm also playing with, and also something from a Chinese company that I refuse to take because I was like, I know how big that is. I know it was the new Pimax one, right?
Pimax Crystal.
The Pimax Crystal. I saw that thing. I was like, that's a TV on your face. I don't get that out of my house. Don't even ship it to me, please. You're seeing all this cool stuff happen, Norm, but how do you feel about VR as a whole, right? Like, I do think the hardware is getting better, but I feel like the games and experiences and the overall like industry is just kind of stagnant at this point.
Yeah, I'll tell you where the places I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic about VR hardware because I think even a small company like Big Screen can create a best in class desktop VR headset. Like they're moving nimbly, moving fast, and sourcing really cutting edge hardware in terms of like the same micro OLED panels that Apple would be using. Not the same resolution, but the same kind of technology, and able to develop their own optics and piggyback off of what Valve is doing with Steam VR for tracking. Right, like that makes me optimistic. The things that I'm less optimistic about is essentially where this converges with augmented reality and the unsolvable problems there. You know, you look at Apple Vision Pro, and one way to look at it is that as advanced that technology is, it is this intermediate step, the perfect version of Apple Vision Pro. If it solves all the problems of tracking and displays and clarity, is still this first step in their mind to something that's maybe an optical pass-through system that's a small form factor. And those physics problems, those battery problems don't feel like they've been solved yet, or I don't know if researchers have a clear path forward even to get there. So when they say, this could be 10 years out, it's really like kicking the ball down the road because there are fundamental physics problems that may prevent these things from ever being a reality.
The dream seems to be like true spatial computing, which could be glasses, but also people hate glasses, I that cannot be the thing. So I've been talking to other people and thinking it could be holographics down the line. It could be something else, like a digital thing just appearing in the real world, but is presenter powered by something outside of you, not even something you're wearing. So I think that we also saw that company, the company's name is escaping me now, but the one with the wearable AI powered device that can project onto your hand. Like we are seeing different ideas kind of going around. So I don't know, maybe we'll see something like that. Is holographic something you've seen at all, Norm, or excited about?
Yeah, I've seen a couple companies do more like glasses-free displays that have volumetric displays in front of you for interaction.
There's the looking glass.
Yeah, I love looking glass. Yep. I have one on my table. I love that. It's a multi-plane view, almost light field. They're like, and it's affordable too in terms of like just making the most out of your portrait mode photos. The thing that helps is that tracking seems to be a solved thing now, and all of these things will need some type of tracking. Every device that we're going to have is going to track relative to each other, whether you're wearing glasses, your phone, or a thing on a table. And the fact that on the background, spatially, there will be a layer that will understand where things are relative to each other in the real world, that then you can overlay, whether it's on your glasses, whether it's projected on a display, whether it's on your phone. Like, that actually feels like the the infrastructure of the metaverse that needs to happen. And that feels like a thing that can be solved.
That's like true Ghost in the Shell territory. But yeah, who knows how long that is going to take. I want to be real quick here. The company I was thinking of was Humane. And we talked about them. We were talking about the Johnny Ive and Sam Altman, like potential AI product. So again, that is something where it's like it is a screenless device that is using AI. And it's projecting onto your hand. It's a different form factor, but not something you're wearing on your face. And I think the whole idea of wearing something in your face is probably... I don't know. There's like an inherent limitation to that and who can try that. So anyway, thank you so much, Norm, for joining us. Anything else you want to mention about the Quest 3 or the state of VR at this point?
There's a lot more accessories, right? I mean, the games launch, I think it's a slow launch. They wanted to get this out before the holiday season, but there are 50 games that are coming out this year. So there's a lot more content to try. I'm personally excited for LEGO Brick Tales, that port from the console and PC game. And of course, Asgard's Wrath and the new Assassin's Creed Nexus. So we'll be looking forward to trying those out.
Oh yeah, I want to play that new Assassin's Creed. I am playing the new one, the Mirage that just came out. So that would certainly be a lot of fun. Where can people find your work online these days, Norm?
They can find it on Tested's YouTube channel. So youtube.com/tested, or I'm on social media on Twitter at nchan and Instagram at normchan.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Norm. And also, Ben, I think you wanted to, like, what was the thing you were working on that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so it's a show called Is This the Metaverse on digiday.com. So if you want to learn about metaverse communities and also advertising in the metaverse, because Digiday is, after all, an advertising industry magazine, check out Is This the Metaverse on digiday.com.
Awesome. I love the folks at Digiday. I'll be checking that out. Thank you, Norm. Thank you, Ben. Thanks to Norm again for joining us. Sam, I really want to know what is going on with you and the Pixel 8s. This feels like a pretty big step forward for Google for its like AI dream. How do you feel about these phones?
And so it was interesting. It's like while I was writing this, it's like obviously Google has been leaning into the AI thing for a long time with the Google Assistant and whatnot. But like as I was using these products more, I'm like, holy crap, like I actually care about AI again. It was feeling like that excitement I had like 4 or 5 years ago is renewed, but in a different way because of how Google is using it on these phones. So we have the new Tensor G3 chip, and even just in general performance, it's noticeably faster. You get better battery life too, which is great. Both Pixels have new actual and super actual displays, which are fine too, but it's really those AI tools, which I think is really starting to separate the Pixel from all the other things because, you know, Apple has done great hardware for a long time. Samsung has, you know, really led on the hardware, game for a long time. They have the best mobile displays on the market and stuff like that. You know, first company to make a real foldable phone. But, you know, Google's bread and butter has always been software. And now adding AI into the mix with that, especially for, and I think my favorite feature is obviously Magic Editor. Because it's just like, it takes that lasso tool and the content aware filter tool from Photoshop and it puts it in the palm of your hand. And it's just so easy to use. You take a photo. The one caveat is that you do have to upload it to Google Photos first. So if you have it set to like your photos set to backup on Wi-Fi, you might have to wait till you get home or do it manually.
Because that stuff is happening on the server, right? It's not happening on your device. So
it's not happening on the server. I just think it's like they want to have a backup in the cloud somewhere so that like,
in case they mess it up. From. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, you can always, back a single photo up manually. That's pretty easy. And then all you have to do is hit the Magic Editor button and then just highlight something with your finger. You can choose to delete it or you can tap and hold and drag it around wherever. And, you know, it's not, you know, a magic, like, one button fixes everything. But if you just want to remove, like, you know, go check out the review, see the photos. I took a bunch of photos and you just, like... I took a photo at a wedding of a recent coworker. Congrats, Valentina,
congrats, Valentina, by the way. I see, photos of you and Sherlyn and folks there. It's just, it looks fun, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I was able to edit out, like, a distracting neon exit sign in the background. I was able to, edit out the, like, a monitor from, like, the DJ booth in the background, too. And it's just, like, these are really subtle things that, like, if you can remove distractions from your photos, it keeps your focus where you want it to be, which is the subjects, you know, the happy couple in that photo. And it's just, like, it takes a lot of the headache out of, hey, I gotta go pull up Photoshop Mobile. I gotta learn how to use it. It's so easy. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's those features are like distinct enough to lean somebody away from a Samsung phone, you know, or even an iPhone? Like, would you get a Pixel just for these AI features?
I think the whole like iOS Android divide is a harder bridge to cross. That's like, I've completely given up on like, hey, you should really switch operating systems, because it's like people don't want to learn.
It's that. Really hard. Yeah.
Yeah. However, if you're like, if you're a Samsung person and you've been like curious about Pixels, I think now is a really great time to switch, because on top of having that AI, Google has been working on their hardware. So, and I think especially the Pixel 8 Pro is a really great option next to something like the S23 Ultra, because not only is it cheaper, but Google has completely upgraded all the sensors on the phone. So they take in more light. You still get that 5x optical zoom. And now with the AI, it just like, you feel like you have more tools at your disposal, which is something that I think everybody, which is like, you always run across that one photo where it's like, hey, this photo is great, but it would be just that much better if I could get rid of this one thing, or if I could move something around. And, you know, it's kind of painful in a way, because, you know, if you want to like, you know, Photoshop your friend standing on top of a statue, you know, you can do that.
Are these features, these are only available through the Pixel phones, right? You can't just do it on Google Photos manually.
Yeah. And
right?
You know, that's part of because, you know, Google is like leveraging the NPU and the machine learning performance in the Tensor G3 chip to power some of these features. And so that is one of the downsides. This is also the first time where I'm really noticing like significant lag between like, you know, having an AI generated whatever. And so you'll do something and you'll sit there and you'll see it generating. And it's like one Mississippi, right, two Mississippi. Right, right. And it takes, you know, 4 or 5, maybe even 6 seconds, depending on what you're doing. And even for something as simple as like generating an AI wallpaper in Android 14. Mm-hmm.
It's funny. There's no reason Google can't just support this on Photos on the web. Like that. Yes, I know it relies on NPU on the system, but your servers have all the hardware you need. So I wonder if Google will just keep it to Pixels for now, because this stuff is expensive. Like they're doing anything, doing a Bing AI command takes a ton of water, takes a ton of energy to even, you know, get that stuff there. So I guess putting most of the workload on the phone is one way to kind of get out of that. I'm glad to hear that you're digging this, Sam. I almost feel like we're seeing the sort of like ultimate form of smartphones from all these companies, right? Like Apple is all about refining what the polish that it has done so well. Samsung is like, I don't know, I have all these ideas, I'm just going to try everything, but also we will pour as much money as we can into the foldables and into crazy zoom cameras, into big screens. And Google now is just like, well, we said AI, what, 7 years ago, 8 years ago. Now the AI dream is kind of here, and they're building a machine kind of around the idea of generative AI. I guess good timing for them. You know, because this seemed like a lost cause for Google just for, up until a couple of years ago. I feel like the Pixel phones were cool, but not like, not really distinctive compared to Samsung or iPhone or anybody else, right?
Right. And this is like sort of redefining Google's like signature capabilities in a way that is tangible. And like everyone talks about like, oh, ChatGPT can do, you know, help you write an email, and Midjourney can make a thing. But you're always having to sit down on your computer. You got to play around with the prompts and the queries. And like this just makes it really easy. And it's also interesting that you mentioned that kind of server processing, because, you know, as good as Magic Editor is, there are some features that Google announced but have not arrived yet, like Video Boost and Video Boost with Night Sight. And that's, you know, you're taking a video and you're uploading it to the cloud, and then Google's doing some processing and then it's downloading it back to the phone, except that it's not available yet. And I think this is also kind of highlights kind of the pros and cons of like what I call Google's software first approach to phone development. Whereas, you know, software has a longer timeline. There's, you know, that old adage that like software is never done, it's just abandoned eventually. And so, you know, we're seeing this where Google's announcing these cool features and it's not arriving until December in a feature drop sometime. And so I don't know if this is going to become a trend, and I really hope it doesn't, because you know, you want all the capabilities that were announced to be available on day one. Another interesting thing is that like, so people are kind of bringing up the whole idea of Magic Editor was like, hey, screenshot or didn't happen, right? Are we into the age of like, everything is manufactured? And I think there's two sides to that. The first is that like, it's a weird question, just because like we already live in the world of Photoshop and Facetune, and it's like, you know, we see people on social media like editing their bodies to make themselves look better, and you know, it's already that easy. And so I don't really think this is pushing the needle one way in a direction one way or another. It's another editing tool, and you know, it's not, you know, you're not creating like a whole new image. This is Magic Editor really is adjusting what's on the frame.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the other part of that is just because, you know, it's editing doesn't mean it's really, you know, manufacturing a new thing. And that said, Google has sort of adjusted the tagline for Google Photos itself to be, hey, this is where you store your memories. They're not saying photos explicitly anymore, because it is a little bit more nebulous in terms of like, hey, what's a photo? What's something that's been generated by AI? And, you know, what's in between?
They're not really saying reality, too, I would say. Like this, I almost feel like philosophically we're seeing the differences between these companies as well, right? Because I think like Apple's focus with the iPhone cameras has always been like realism, you know, or the ability to capture the shot as you see it. They have like their own like AI processing tools that will sort through a bunch of images to find you the best image, the best possible image that you already took, not without post-processing and stuff. And now they're doing a bit of that. I feel like Samsung was always about, I want your image, I want the most fun images you have, right? Like they were like a hyper color saturation.
Super saturated, yeah, like extra realistic version, because super bright colors, like, you know, sometimes their processing goes over sharp.
Exactly.
And you know, you see that every once in a while, but like, you know, they're trying to make things as delightful and like attention grabbing,
poppy and fun.
Yeah.
And now Google's also like AI magic, right? AI all the things. You know, even the very definition of what a photo is, I think, is starting to get blurred, because sure, you could do a lot of this stuff in Photoshop, but also that's hard. Not everybody knows Photoshop. That requires skills. But now you could do it with like the touch of a button to remove an annoying photo bomber from the back of a photo or something. Yeah, I do feel like it is like fundamentally changing the notion of photography. It's kind of fascinating that Google would do this. Do you think Apple would follow up with similar features?
It's interesting, because as we saw at like the WWDC not too long ago, Apple was kind of like mum on the whole topic of AI in general. They, you know, it seemed like they specifically avoided saying AI completely. And I think Apple is, this is something Apple is considering, but it's, you know, in typical Apple fashion, they are not going to be the people who are great breaking ground on this. They are going to work in the background to polish and refine it. And then, hey, maybe it comes out a little bit later, but once it comes out, it'll be a very, you know, put together product where, you know, there won't be as many like maybe moral or ethical questions about it, because those have been already answered by, you know, other apps and software. And so they get to kind of sidestep those questions and then just focus on, hey, we're just trying to make your photos look as good as possible.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So overall, it seems like you really dig these phones, Sam. Like, good upgrades from the Pixel 7 or Pixel 6? Like, at what point are these like must-haves for people?
If you have a Pixel 7, I it's really hard to recommend anyone upgrade after just a year.
Yeah.
But if you are on the Pixel 6, I would consider it a lot more deeply, especially if you are like, you know, your phone is, the battery's not great and you have, you know, other issues with the phone and like, hey, it might be time to upgrade.
That was also a slow processor, like when it launched, right? They were using like a mid-range Snapdragon, I believe, at that point, or a mid-range equivalent Qualcomm chip. So you would see a big speed bump from this.
Yeah, and so just in terms of like general performance from the Tensor G1 to the G2, you didn't see a big jump. And I've noticed that it definitely, the phone feels noticeably faster in the jump from the Tensor G2 to the G3 on the Pixel 8, definitely.
Gotcha. So, okay, Pixel 8, Pixel 8 Pro looks good. Check out Sam's full review on the site. Video is going to be incoming soon, I know. We also reviewed, Sherlyn reviewed the Pixel Watch 2, which is kind of interesting too, because she scored this thing as a 79. The headline is not leading the way, but no longer lagging. Do you have any impressions on this one, Sam?
So I've been using the Pixel Watch 2 as well, and I think that headline is actually really, like, really encompasses how I feel about the watch as well. Because when the original Pixel Watch came out, like, the battery life was by far the biggest issue. It would not even make it through a full day. It would, like, if I put it on in the morning, it would be dead by 9 p.m. And for something that's supposed to monitor your health and fitness all the time and do sleep tracking, it just wasn't an option. And so now I'm getting a full 24 hours of battery life with always on display on all the time. And so they've fixed that. That said, like, they've switched over to a new charger that uses, like, actual, like, pins on it instead of wireless charging, and so the old charger is incompatible, and even the new one, it only fits on the watch in one particular direction, and it's just, like, it's weird little issues like that, and the design is almost exactly the same, and there's no larger model, which is something I really wanted for a long time, and I really feel like we're kind of running into the situation where, like, you know, you have the product cycles, and, you know, people are planning for 2 and 3 years out. And I think they had already originally planned this as a 2-year product cycle. Yeah. And so, you know, the design was locked in. Maybe next year we'll get some tweaks or a larger model. That remains to be seen. And, you know, they have also redesigned a lot of the Fitbit app. So, you know, it's easier to use and things are just incorporated a lot more tightly. And I think that is, like, one thing that, like, I think Google had been struggling with for a while is that integration of, we have all these Google teams and we have all the Fitbit teams and now everyone has to get together and play nicely. And I think they're kind of starting to pick up, you know, the rhythm on that. Mm-hmm. And so everything feels just a little bit more harmonious.
It took a while. Like, it took a long time before we really started to see the fruits of the Fitbit and Google stuff, like that whole acquisition. So this is cool. Like, it's a cool looking watch. Sherlyn brings up, like, a specific point that the crown kind of sticks out so much that she sometimes accidentally hits it when moving her wrist because it looks like she's wearing the watch way high up. That seems annoying because sometimes my Apple Watch gets up that high. So,
Yeah. I mean, this for me just goes back to, like, I think the Samsung rotating bezel is, like, the greatest marriage of, like, analog and digital design. And I, like, the crown's fine. I can see how that would happen on certain people. I think it might be more prone, like you said, if you wear higher up on your wrist. I haven't run into that myself, but I can definitely see that happening.
Do you think, it seems like Google has reached somewhat feature parity between the Samsung Watch. How close do you think it is to the Apple Watch at this point?
I think just the legacy of the Apple Watch, we're almost at like 10 years of Apple Watches. Yeah. And so, like, they have, like, so many accessories, so many apps, so many
bands and
so many watch faces and bands. And, like, that whole ecosystem just feels so much more mature than anything Google has to offer. And, you know, you can't really blame them. They've only been at this for 2 years now. But at the same time, there's also no, like, apologizing for it either. It's just, like, I was trying to set it up the other day where it's like, hey, I want to have my, there's no Hue app for the Wear OS, as far as I can tell. And it's like, I just want to be able to adjust the colors of my lights for my watch, which seems like the most natural thing in the world. And, you know, there is some smart home integration where you can turn lights on and off, but I want, you know, a little bit more granular control. And for that, like, it seems like I should be able to change lights from red to blue just on my watch without pulling them out my phone, but that doesn't really seem like an option, at least right now.
It seems like you should be able to just talk to your watch to make that happen instantly too. Like, you know, assistant stuff would be nicer. How is the AI powered assistant on the new Pixel, by the way, yet?
Yeah. So, you know, it has, you know, full voice integration. So if you want to ask it stuff, you know, it's still getting the information from your phone, but yeah, you can do that.
That's cool. That seems tempting. I'm starting to test out the Windows 11 build with Copilot. And I'm thinking of an editorial on this. I will say, like, it's nice to have this stuff at the touch of a button, right? Because somebody was asking, you know, what's the difference between these two LG OLED TVs, right? The A3 and the B3, or no, the B3 and the C3. And it's like, that's one of those things where I'm like, even I know the TV market. I'm like, I don't actually remember the specific differences. And you can ask Copilot and just like, hey, give me a table, compare these specs, please. And it'll do it. It is that thing where you do have to sit and wait, because it is kind of doing a miraculous thing, but it's like back in the old days when you were on a dial-up modem and you were waiting for a 100K image to load. Like, you're sitting and waiting for magic to happen, which I think, I don't know if people are going to be put off by that or just like, will they give it a break because what it's giving you is sort of like miraculous information. I don't know. So, okay, I will have more on that in a bit too. Any other thoughts, Sam, on the Pixels, Pixel hardware? Because you've seen everything at this point.
Yeah, I really think that, like, when, you know, Google kind of reintroduced and redesigned the Pixel 6 with the Tensor G1, you know, we were kind of like getting a taste of what direction Google was trying to go. And now, like, three generations into that, like, relaunch, it really feels like Google's kind of hitting its stride in terms of like, hey, this AI hype cycle buzziness has been, you know, it's all people have been talking about for the last 6 months. But now they're kind of cutting through the noise in a little bit and making AI easy to use in a way that doesn't feel scary and also doesn't, you know, feel like it's a challenge. Like, it's very easy. And I also think that, like, especially for Magic Editor and, like, how that plays into Google Photos, it's almost, like, romantic in a way, because by saying that, like, hey, this is where you store your memories, this is, like, you know, when you edit your photos to remove distracting elements, that's how you want to remember and that's how you remember it in your head. And so by making, you know, the photos match up with the memories in your head, because you're not going to remember that exit sign or whatever, I think it's just, like, it almost feels a little, like, romantic in a very kind of storybook way. Yeah, and yeah. I think that is maybe, like, a little bit of AI optimism, which seems, you know, kind of refreshing in a time when everyone's all very doom and gloom about it.
It can be helpful. But at the same time, like, what is Apple doing, right? Apple is letting you use the Pro cameras to create a, you know, spatialize a 3D version of photos and videos so you can actually revisit your memories with the depth you remember, but without, like, cleaning it up with AI. So, again, different strategies to achieve this idea of storing your memories, just kind of fascinating. I don't have the 15 Pro Max yet, but I'm looking forward to testing that stuff out. Okay, thank you so much, Sam, and stay tuned for further updates on all this stuff. I think, have we had hands-on with the new Pixel Buds Pro feature yet? I think those are dropping eventually, right?
Yeah, I don't think so just yet, but yeah, stay tuned.
Likely Billy Steele will be covering that for us, but okay, thank you so much, Sam. Let's move on to some other news. And first up, I do want to note this correction from Wired. Last week, we brought up the story. It was an editorial from a former DuckDuckGo executive who posited, based on a slide of material from the FTC versus Google trial, that Google was doing this thing where it was changing your search queries after you made them to make them more money, basically to push different ads, to push certain results. And at the time when we discussed that, we said, this is an editorial. Didn't look like she had, like, we didn't actually see the proof of this. And it turns out not too long after that, Wired issued a formal, like, retraction of this piece. There's a statement now, if you go to the link for that article, after careful review of the op-ed, how Google alters search queries to get at your wallet, and relevant material provided to us following its publication, Wired editorial has determined the story does not meet our editorial standards. It has been removed. This is the nuclear option for any news site. So specifically, if it's a full retraction is always
like a big thing.
I mean, yeah. It was in the editorial section. So I think everybody gives op-eds a little bit of leeway to be like, well, yeah, this is your opinion, right? But I think it was hedged in a way that it felt like reporting, and also other people really ran with that story too. So, hey, this does not mean this thing is not necessarily happening. It just means that that article did not fully prove that it was the case. So it's still in question, but a really interesting move from Wired's part there.
And I think the tone of the piece was kind of what got people a little confused, because it was almost like asserting fact based on speculation. And I think that is where things can get a little bit weird, especially when you're, like, writing an op-ed, but it feels more like an investigative report than an op-ed. And I think that was, you know, one of the big issues for that story.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we will. Yeah. I'm certainly, like, intrigued by learning the inner workings of how Google search works, but that clearly was not it. So, yeah, just keep that in mind, folks. Moving on, another thing that was certainly big news over the weekend. We saw the news around the surprise attack by Hamas in Israel, the resulting, basically resulting strike, the strike against it by Israel, too. So now there is a full-on conflict happening in the Middle East. And one thing people have been talking about and noticing is that X, which I will always call Twitter, has basically failed completely. A lot of the trending topics that were in place over the weekend and throughout this week were completely incorrect, either outright lies or misinformation. I saw a lot of blue check accounts going around spreading misinformation because they get paid based on engagement, right? So if tensions are high and people, you think people will react to this thing you're putting out. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. So
and anyone can just get a blue check nowadays too.
Well, you can get a blue check by paying for it, and then Twitter supposedly pays you too. So I just want to shout out two things that I think people should pay attention to here. There's a great episode of On the Media, which is one of my favorite podcasts and radio shows from WNYC. The midweek episode specifically talks about like how X has failed here, and there's a conversation with a Reuters reporter about this, Avi Asher Shapiro, who has been studying, you know, the way social media works for a long time and the way misinformation has plagued Twitter, certainly. And it's not to say like Twitter was perfect before Elon Musk, but certainly now it seems like all the safeguards are gone. So we could just not, we can't trust anything Twitter says anymore as a news source, which is something I know a lot of people were using Twitter for. I just can't trust it. Like, how do you feel at this point, Sam?
I think in a really kind of unfortunate and depressing way, this is sort of what Elon's been going for the whole time. Just by removing all the safeguards and all the content moderation teams at Twitter. And I think, like, it's almost like this kind of weird sadistic experiment to see how far you can push what is truly like an unmoderated social media platform. And unfortunately, we're witnessing that firsthand.
It's truly sad. I also want to shout out a great newsletter from Ryan Broderick, a former guest on this show, over at Garbage Day. It's titled, "This is What an Unmoderated Internet Looks Like." And I think he raises a lot of good points here. It's just like social media networks for the past decade and beyond, I think, have been trying to do something about misinformation. And ever since Elon Musk took over Twitter, and certainly now at other sites, it looks like just that goal is not there anymore. Threads specifically, like Meta executives have said, like Threads is not focusing on nudes. It's news. It's not focusing on like anything divisive. It wants things to be, it wants you to have a happy time. It wants you to have a fun time over Threads. Don't worry about news. Don't worry about potential wars and far off countries. Let's just share, you know, the latest memes. And
yeah, build your brand up. Build your brand. Sell some merch, get some sponsors. But as far as like news and, you know, important current topics, maybe, you know, not the right
maybe
place.
Not the right place. Any social media, honestly. There were a lot of reports about younger folks using TikTok to find news, right? There are TikTok reporters who are out there just like basically explaining news and doing what like entry level reporters typically do. A recent study that Neiman Lab reported on also says, like, the news will not find you on TikTok. It's honestly kind of a wasteland. They're pointing to a specific study here. Out of 6,568 videos studied by a bot, only six could be actually classified as news. The rest, and some of those were two different videos that were shown multiple times. The rest were, you know, crazy TikTok, you know, reactions to it, or a lot of like misinformation that was landing here. So TikTok will not save you either. Like, you just kind of have to go to direct news sources, it seems. Get your RSS feeds cleaned up. Have you tried Artifact at all, Sam? Like, I bring this up sometimes.
I have not.
That's the like new app from, isn't it from the former Reddit executives, I believe? Or no, Instagram executives, the original Instagram folks. That's the news app that's trying to like give you a curated experience and gamifying things a little. And I found that to be kind of useful. It does highlight things. And it's, at least I'm not getting garbage, right? I'm not getting pure misinformation there. So that's something. You can also curate like the sites and sources you want to get news from. So yeah, it is a shame to see what's happened to Twitter. And it doesn't look like that's going to change anytime soon. Another story I wanted to bring up, we briefly mentioned also during the FTC trial, like some information was leaked out about how much Google is paying Apple to keep Google Search as its default option on the iPhone. I think initially the numbers the Fed was talking about was like up to $10 billion. It seemed more like $5 billion. But now another report, which the Register is reporting on here, says that it could actually be between $18 to $20 billion. Which seems to be
that's a lot of money.
That is, let me see here. That is 14 to 16% of Apple's annual operating profits. And that amount of money sort of like solidifies, like, why would Apple say no to this? You know, why would Apple ever develop its own search engine? Why would Apple ever give you the choice to do this because it is just, they are just printing money just by having Google there. That's just kind of wild to me.
I mean, it's pretty much just free money.
It's free money. Yeah. It's free money. I mean, Apple doesn't not typically like sell its screen space, but in this case, it's not like they have a good search engine option of their own either. There were reports that they were working on one. There were reports we talked about last week that Microsoft was trying to sell Bing to Apple. But, you know, buying Bing is spending money to get a thing that would not earn you $18 to $20 billion a year.
And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, in the background, Apple is taking some of that money and, you know, diverting it to a team within Apple who may be, you know, doing development on their own search. You know, not going to come out anytime soon, but, you know, there have been some rumors about something like that. So, hey, you take all this money and you're able to channel it into your own R&D and, you know, maybe one of these days you don't have to take that money and you have your own product that, you know, hey.
Can earn that much? I don't know. Like, that's...
maybe not earn that much, but at least put a dent in Google's, like, extreme monopoly on the search market.
I almost feel like this would be the reason why, especially with, like, the government looking closer, like, how Google's managing these contracts. Eventually, Apple may have to be like, well, maybe we can't do this anymore. Or at least maybe we can't, legally take this money to make Google the priority. Maybe we should give people a choice, but also maybe it's more worth it to do our own thing somehow. And there are reports about that in terms of like how Spotlight search works on Macs and iPhones too. So, you know, Apple is doing its own thing, but it's not a web crawler. It's not as powerful as what Google's doing. I almost wonder, like, people are positioning the future of search as sort of like the generative AI stuff, Sam, but I almost wonder, there's so much other content out there, right? Nothing is really indexing what is inside YouTube videos. Nothing is indexing the content of podcasts. And I feel like that's something that I would like to see at some point too, right?
And I think this is all like sort of, we're seeing that like evolution of search is like, hey, what is Google going to apply AI to this to try to make, and you can kind of see this in terms of like, you know, using search to find sources and then aggregate them in a more digestible way. And so, yeah, absolutely. This is all kind of like how search is evolving over time into being just not just a way to find content or a way to, you know, find the location of a restaurant, but as like a way to, you know, learn how to compare things and as a shopping tool and pretty much everything else.
It's kind of like, it is funny how much stuff is on the internet now that we just cannot find anymore. Not just because they're in like walled gardens, right? Because, you know, social media networks don't always open their stuff up. But it is podcast especially is something I'm thinking about as somebody who's been podcasting for a while. Wasn't Google's initial mission to like index everything, like index all the information in the world? And that, it seems like if you're going to do that, you have to figure out a way to see what's going on inside audio and video as well. So yeah, anyway.
I mean, that plays right into Google's like language recognition and all that, because hey, if you can run every podcast on the internet through a tool and get a transcription, suddenly it's a lot easier to index.
I wonder if the failure of Google Books, like remember Google Books, like the initial thing was, we're just going to scan all the books. And then, what was it? The Authors Guilds, I believe. Yeah. Like, just really
Some copyright and legality issues around that. And yeah, that put a big wrench in the works.
I think they
one.
Pretty much just stopped at least doing it at a large scale as they used to. So, hey, that door is wide open. That is my secret podcast, my secret startup idea. I make a magical algorithm that could tell you what's happening in the podcast. People will love it. In other news, the FTX trial, the fraud trial, the federal trial against Sam Bankman-Fried is happening right now. And Carolyn Ellison, who served as CEO of Alameda, which was the, That was the trading firm that was kind of tied to FTX. FTX is the crypto firm. Sam Bankman-Fried founded both. Carolyn Ellison has been on the witness stand for the past 2 days talking about her experience. And really just, it's worth reading the New York Times like breakdown of this stuff, but really saying that Sam Bankman-Fried pretty much directed her to commit a lot of these crimes, specifically the whole thing about taking money from FTX and putting it into Alameda, basically taking customer money, not really telling people what was happening, just lying, basically outright lying with where this money is coming from, bribing Chinese executives or bribing Chinese officials to release some money that they also had in some crypto exchanges. A lot of things, a lot of bad things. And also Carolyn Ellison, the headlines a lot of people are also running with, like, she was his one-time girlfriend too. Like, it's a weird relationship. He was also her boss. Just a weird thing. But I think it's worth reading what is happening with this trial, because I remember when I didn't know who Sam Bankman-Fried was. And now all of a sudden, like, he is one of the greatest financial criminals we've ever had in America.
Yeah, he right up there with, like, Bernie Madoff. Like, right up there. You know, he's, yeah.
There's a lot of reporting that if he's convicted, he could end up serving life in prison for the amount of money that he ended up outright stealing there. So, yeah, we're paying attention to that. There will likely be some coverage on Engadget. We just haven't been following it day to day. In gadget-related news, though, Sony announced a smaller PlayStation 5 with a detachable disk drive. These were all rumored earlier this year. I believe we even brought it up a couple of times. But yeah, new PS5s. It's a PS5 Slim. Sony says it has 30% lower volume and it's 18% lighter than the original. So there's a new digital version, which has no disk drive once again, but the full price, the $500 version, has a removable 4K Blu-ray drive that kind of clips onto the side. If you buy the digital one, which is now more expensive, it's $450. You can also buy the drive separately for $80 and just clip it on down the line. So, okay, kind of what we were expecting. Any surprises here, Sam? Any thoughts on this hardware?
Some small positives is that you now get a 1 terabyte SSD as storage, as opposed to like the weird 870 something gig one on the
so
original.
So weird, yeah.
So that's a small positive. And the interesting thing is, like, the design is still basically the same shape, which is like, I don't even know what to call that shape. It's just like swervy. It looks like drapes to me. That's how I've described it. Having a smaller PS5 is great, because that the original one is huge. So
it's big.
No complaints.
It's smaller, likely because they were able to use smaller chips, more efficient chips to deliver the same amount of power. Do want to point out, I think one of the fatal flaws of the original PlayStation 5 is you still kind of need a stand to even sit it horizontally because of the weird shape of this whole thing. And yes, you will still, there is still a stand to lay this thing down horizontally. Like, Sony did not learn their lesson there. Just kind of funny. There is a vertical stand compatible with all PS5 models for $30. So I guess that's a new stand that's going to be rolling out. Okay, anyway, PS5 Slim. Kind of cool. Exactly what we're expecting. Also, briefly, I want to mention we wrote about California's right to repair bill is now California's right to repair law. Governor Newsom signed the legislation on Tuesday of this week. And it's been years that we've been writing about this and getting this up there. Certainly, organizations like iFixit have been supporting this for a while. And something we had mentioned last week, too, the whole thing about Google offering replacement parts and, you know, support for Pixel 8s for 7 years is kind of tied to this, because basically devices, anything over $100 will have to be covered by a 7-year, not warranty, but a 7-year term for replacement parts from companies. And violating that could cost up to $1,000 per day, $2,000 for the second day, you know, $5,000 afterwards. So California is also making it a big deal for companies to actually support their hardware and make it easy for you to repair them. That's a good thing overall. Are you have you fixed any of your smaller gadgets on your own, Sam?
I replaced the back glass on an old Samsung phone a while back, and this was like a S7 or an S8. And back then, getting parts was like you had to go on like Alibaba and get them, like order them from China because they weren't available anywhere else. So just having that is just like, okay, that's really, really nice. You know, it's important to note that like the law doesn't go into effect until July 1st of 2024. So there is going to be a little gap until, you know, when things start to really take effect. And for gadgets under $100, device makers have to stock replacement parts for 3 years instead of seven. Seven's for, you know, more expensive gadgets like smartphones, laptops, what have you.
That's something. And I also believe like some things are not included, like game consoles, right? Let me see here. Game consoles, alarm systems, heavy industrial equipment that, quote, vitally affects the general economy of the state, public interest, and public welfare are not included in this in the right to repair law. So yeah, I guess those were carve-outs that were necessary to get this thing to pass. But hey, good news for California. I'm looking forward to this becoming federal legislation eventually, if we could ever make that happen. That would be wonderful. Let's move on to what we're working on. Sam, I know you have a couple things in mind. What do you want to shout out?
Yeah, well, I'm working on a foldable phone review that I can't quite talk about yet. If you know, if you've been paying attention to leaks and rumors, you might have a guess what it is, and maybe have time to sneak in another video game review. Hopefully we'll have more on that on the site next week.
Gotcha. Cool. And I want to say I'm still in VR land after, you know, reviewing the Quest 3. I have the Big Screen Beyond VR headset, which is less a headset and more like a pair of like just digital glasses that slip onto my head. They are so light. And so it's just wild like how these things actually work. So I'll have more thoughts on them soon, especially coming from a company known for doing a VR app. It is crazy to see this hardware actually out in the wild. Do want to shout out our e-commerce team. Amazon Prime Day was this week, actually throughout the week, and our commerce team selected a lot of cool deals. We've got a lot of good coverage of this stuff, so stay tuned to Engadget for all those things. And if you missed any of them, I do believe like some of them, if you're a Prime member, like it's not just like one day. You can actually go back and get some of the deals afterwards. So go check out all of our coverage there. And didn't you do the Sony Buds as well, Sam?
Yeah, I also did a quick hands-on with Sony's new InZone earbuds. And those are kind of interesting because they have the same drivers as the Sony... And I can never... Sony, please fix this name. It's like the XF1000, X5s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they have the same drivers and, you know, similar ANC technology. So really good noise canceling. The one issue is that the case is like weirdly very huge. Large, and it doesn't have wireless charging supported, so you can only charge it with a USB cable. But it's interesting because I think, you know, if you just want one pair of earbuds that you can use with everything and you are a big gamer, you might actually be interested in something like the InZone Buds just because, hey, they come with a dedicated USB dongle so you can plug it into your PS5 or your PC. And then you have a dedicated 2.4 gigahertz audio channel. But it also works with Bluetooth LE, so you can use it with your phone. And that's kind of nice because I just left it connected to Bluetooth on my phone, like you would on a regular pair of earbuds. And then I could switch over to the dongle for, you know, lower latency, higher quality audio, wireless audio. And that was really nice.
That's kind of cool. It's weird that it is a whole separate model than like their actual high-end premium earbuds, but I'd hope to see some of these features in those eventually, but it's cool. Yeah, this is intriguing. I always love Sony's headphone stuff. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. I just want to quickly shout out, like, hey, I finished Ahsoka. We talked about Ahsoka when that thing started, and I think briefly in mid-season, I think I started to like it more. I think it's still a weird narrative mess, you know, from Dave Filoni, who has been responsible for a lot of the Star Wars animated stuff since the late 2000s. But there's also like enough cool stuff there, like enough cool lightsaber battles and great imagery and, you know, great character work, I think, from a lot of people involved that make it worth watching. I just really wish those first two episodes weren't so inscrutable because really, even the finale, like they don't care if you did not watch the cartoons.
They hinge a lot. Yeah, they hinge a lot on your previous knowledge of, you know, Rebels and, some of the animated shows. And so it can be, my wife ran into this, especially because she hasn't seen those shows. And so she was just like, she kind of tuned out.
Why should I care about a lot of this? Yeah.
And then once she had gotten into some of the newer characters in the episodes and like had gotten more context around the returning ones, she started to get into it more. And then like, you know, as you got to the end of the show, it's like, oh, hey, like I actually wanted to see more from those characters. And then, you know, the season one's over. But hey, I think hopefully... It seems like they set it up to really transition into a season two very well.
I hope so. I hope it's like it can stand on its own because to me, that link to the animated shows, I love great animated shows. Like I love continuity like that. It just feel like it did not do the work to kind of really connect things. So there is that. Check out Ahsoka. Certainly check out Andor if you haven't seen that yet. It is nice to see good Star Wars stuff around. Certainly better than that last season of Mandalorian, certainly better than the Boba Fett show.
My one like issue with like the Star Wars is that like the whole when Disney bought Star Wars and they completely non-canonized a bunch of stuff, and now they're bringing back some of the characters from the old like legacy Legends content, and they're just like it feels a lot like what Disney is doing with MCU, but it's like it just doesn't feel It feels a little bit ham-fisted sometimes for anyone who has been a longtime fan of the pre-Disney Star Wars content.
It's confusing, but at least you know what's going on. I feel like the longtime fans are at least better equipped right now to understand what's going on. What do you want to shout out, Sam? What have you been watching?
I know you probably talked about this a while back, but I'm finally getting a chance to dive into Miss Davis, which is just like a weird bonkers. I appreciate the weirdness, and I think that's what I really like. It's just like off the wall, kind of crazy, and you know, but also like weirdly topical with having this omniscient AI overlord. And so I'm only a few episodes in, but I'm really enjoying it so far.
Awesome. And yeah, this is a show, by the way, starring Betty Gilpin. She is playing a nun who is fighting AI. Nun versus AI.
On the quest for the Holy Grail.
Holy Grail, certainly. Of course she is. It's a funny year for this to come out because I also think the creator has a lot of this too, and I did not like the creator as much as I like the bonkersness of this show. So
yeah. I want to watch the creator because I think it looks great, but like, you know, you've mentioned that some issues with the plot and the theming.
Watch it. It's so worth seeing in theater because it does look beautiful.
Okay.
Like, it's worth doing a matinee if you can sneak out. We will not tell anybody that you're out watching movies, Sam. But yeah, so I'm glad you're liking Mrs. Davis. Everybody check it out. It is on Peacock. That's it for our episode this week, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elliman, who occasionally chats on the podcast too. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter, I will never say X, also on Mastodon and Blue Sky and all those fun things. Where can we find you, Sam?
You can also find me on Twitter at Sam Rutherford, and of course on Engadget.com.
And where can we find you, Ben?
Find me on literally my email. Just send me an email at benelman.wave, that's WAV, at gmail.com.
I feel like that's cheating. We're here to pump our socials, Ben. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Thanks, folks. We're out.